Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falcons from Falcons Green, and we are joined by Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
Yo!
And freelance writing critic Virat Nehru.
Hello, hello.
And we have a very special guest joining us, the One Heat Minute founder and host, as well as freelance film critic and 2ESR alumni, Blake Howard. Blake, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, guys. I wish I could be there in person, but people will hear that I'm quite husky at the moment. It's a real pleasure to finally be on the show.
Hey, cheers.
Yeah, it's good to have you here because it's fair, you know, you've had a big weekend, so it's very good to have a bit of rest. Fair, your voice a little husky because you've been recording for, wow, a long time.
Like almost 2 years?
2 years, yeah. A little over 2 years ago was the first gestation of the idea. And then 2 years later, as of the weekend, I was getting close to finishing the show. And my son Keaton turned one on Saturday. So I thought, what would be a better thing for me than to just load this day up with two important milestones, which is the end of One Heat Minute and my son's first birthday. So I dropped it on his birthday. And yeah, it's pretty crazy.
It's a pretty nice weekend. It is,
yeah,
a really
congratulations,
nice one.
Man.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We should note that we will be talking with Blake at the commencement, but later in the frag, we will be discussing Booksmart, and then which is in cinemas on Thursday. And on the podcast, we'll be discussing Hail Satan, which is going to be at the Sydney Film Festival's, also getting a general release on tomorrow, Thursday. But first, we want to talk about One Heat Minute because we want to hear what it's all about, but also you've alluded to it, but there's been some pretty big news this weekend.
Yeah, look, so I'll start with what it is. It's pretty simple. The 1995 crime opus, Heat, written, directed, produced by Michael Mann, examined 1 minute at a time chronologically. One Heat Minute. And the show has been just this epic undertaking and analysis that started off with 1 minute and a variety of guests taking anywhere in between sort of 15 to 35 minutes into pretty much the average time, 45 minutes to an hour for every single minute of the film. Two episodes released a week, about a two-year project in all. And I've had an absolute cavalcade of some of the world's most amazing critical voices and creative, filmmakers like Joe Lynch, Michael Mann collaborators like Dante Stanotti and Pasquale Buber, actors and directors like Bill Duke, great critical voices, Noah Dargis, Bill Beery, Walter Chaw, Matt Zoller-Zeit. The list is truly epic. And this weekend, I was so grateful and lucky and really kind of surreal. It was the most surreal experience of my entire sort of career. I got to close out the show, the final minute, the 166th minute of the film, with the filmmaker Michael Mann. And so it became the perfect way to end, and it went out with a bang, so to speak. And it's kind of this unbelievably surreal experience of finishing the show after unpacking this movie, which I have such a deep affection for, with the man who created it, and it was just a joy, and I can't thank you guys enough for having us on and all the kind words you've said so far, but just the outpouring of the amazing sort of film community internationally has been utterly staggering.
Bravo, dude. Bravo.
When you started off the project, I'm guessing you never imagined, obviously, Michael Mann, but even some of these larger international critical presences making it onto the show. Is that right?
Yeah, look, absolutely not. To be brutally honest with you guys, I started this project as, it was in a proof of concept stage. It was like, could this even work? You know, there had been minute-by-minute podcasts before, but I had a very specific vision that I wanted a very diverse group of people to talk about it, and I always wanted to be re-energized and re-engaged and, challenged by different critical voices that we could sort of debate and discuss this film. And so in my mind, I wanted to get people who really loved the movie on, but I also wanted to challenge it. And so as it grew, I guess, my aspirations or the things that I might have held back or thought of or dreamed about or wished, in some imaginary world these things would happen, and then they started happening. You know, my favorite film critic in the world is Manola Dargis. And, she was on an episode 30. You know, there's 166-minute episodes. There's a stack of bonus episodes we did as well as part of the show. But, then it just started to build this incredible momentum. And we had this incredible cachet of generous guests. And they would just pass this on to the next people or elevate it with their audiences. And it started to, very much legitimize the project. And as that grew, so did my aspirations, culminating with Michael Mann. Like, I wouldn't have even wanted to mention it to anyone that I would have wanted him on the show in the beginning, because it would have felt like such an unrealistic thing. But as it became, as the project grew and as it came together, there became only one way really to end it. And if he was available and he was, if he endorsed the show, then, you know, he had to help us close it out.
Right.
Because who's going to follow Michael Mann?
Yeah, exactly.
No one wants to do that.
After 170 episodes, the big question is, why Heat?
I just love it. Yeah. I love it so much. I just think it is an unparalleled masterpiece. I think it's entertaining. I think it's engaging, and I think it's deeply effective. And so, you know, movies, you know, for everyone who listens to your show and all of you guys as individuals, you know, there's things that sort of passively are very entertaining, you know, very well crafted, something formally really kind of cool. Then there's other movies that maybe don't work on the formal level, but on a deep thematic level, they touch you, or characters that are super relatable. And for me, the more I unpack Heat, like, every single element I think is functioning in such a unity that it just, its potency is just unbelievable. Every scene to scene, character, theme, emotional trajectory, you know, formal grammar, just the craft and just the commitment of every single person. And I mean from cinematography to the complimentary music to all this wonderful 70-strong speaking actors, some of the greatest actors in American cinema, all being commanded with Michael Mann, who he himself is such a dynamic, fastidious filmmaker. And so I think it's like this perfect storm of elements that I just never get tired of in any way. And I've just had an absolute blast watching it, unpacking it, and just bringing these incredible critical voices around this sort of beautiful campfire to talk about this movie.
Absolute blast indeed. I wanted to touch upon, look, we talk about a lot this death of the critic idea and that there is no such film community left. But what this podcast kind of re-energized as you're talking about, this idea that there is an international film community of not just critics, but film lovers, actually, that we actually genuinely love film so much. And that kind of gets lost in this critical evaluation and people seeing themselves as critics rather than seeing themselves as film lovers first. So I think what your podcast has done has really sort of re-energized that discussion about this love for film in general.
Oh, look, I'm deeply moved by that. So thank you. And what I would say is I think sometimes you need time. You know, that's one thing about this movie is that I was never fully satiated on having spoken about it enough or written about it enough. Or I, you know, even if I gushed about it to you, you know, great gents right now in this show, I wouldn't feel satisfied that it had enough critical scrutiny. And the great film critic for The New Yorker, Anthony Lane, used to say, you either review the movie the day and date that it comes out and you file your review for that weekend, or you never talk about it again for 10 years.
Right.
And what I don't necessarily agree with that, but what I really like about that approach is that he was very much around capturing whatever culturally was happening with the movie and then if it stayed relevant. And I think that staying power is so important. And that's where that really breeds love, like those films that people continue to go back to. And so this movie and the people that I've spoken to, and particularly Michael Mann as a filmmaker, just seems to have these movies that people just rally behind and continually revisit. And so it became this big loving thing. And you know, you can be critical of something and still love it. And that's what I've tried to do on the show. I was never afraid to be critical of it at all, my guests. to be fair, some of my guests actually don't like Heat, but they respect it. And so they respect what it's aspiration. They respect its ambition. They respect its scale. So I think that's what's really great. And so if my project and the amazing contributors to the project have done anything, anything, and you're saying that it's and you guys are thinking that it's reinvigorating that love, then I'm all for it, because that's exactly what this project was set out to be.
Now, you mentioned Michael Mann, and on that subject, I listened to the podcast, and it's quite a thing to have the director, not just the director of the film, but someone of such esteem. And what really struck me was many directors will not wax lyrical, will not go into their thinking or the conception behind films, and others will, whereas Michael Mann, he went into such detail. And I want to know, from the perspective of someone who's studied Heat for so many years, what was it like to hear firsthand from this perspective? But furthermore, did it challenge some of the other what conceptions you've had of Heat, or many other views that have come over the months and now years of putting together this podcast?
Yeah, God, it was surreal. I was having out-of-body experiences. It was like, imagine us four could sit here and talk and all have these different opinions, but to get it from the source, it's kind of really incredible. And I don't think it, to answer one part of your question first, is I don't think it ever made me revisit some of the great theories or some of the great takes that have happened on my show. But what it did was it really lined up with, like, intentionality. So, you know, so much of being a filmmaker and an artist is you have an intention of what you want the audience to be feeling in a given moment. And I think that, you know, what was really striking about listening to Mr. Mann talk through this was I was just completely taken with his command of his intent and how that was being relayed to the audience. So he really was far closer to us feeling along the lines that he wanted us as the audience to feel in Heat than I think many directors get to. And I think that that's what really kind of struck me, was that the very greatest filmmakers in the world are really commanding your emotions in precisely the way that they want to, are orchestrating you and getting you to take the precise ride that they're intending you to take. And then you not only take that ride, but you bring your baggage and your life experience and your taste to that and enrich their take. And so, yeah, I don't feel like it ever took away for a take. In fact, it blew my mind. Like, the, you know, one of the famous scenes in the film is the tunnel scene. And it's the scene where Neil McCauley, Robert De Niro, is driving along with Edie, Amy Brenneman, and he's just gotten off the phone with John Boyd's Nate character, and Nate has set him up a new out. He's about to leave. And he basically says, you know, take it easy, brother, you're home free.
Mm.
And De Niro in that scene has got to have this cavalcade of tsunami of emotions on his face. He's got to be tortured with the choice. Does he go and kill Kevin Gage, Wayne Groh, who betrayed their crew and got them into this mess and to a large extent? Or does he fly to New Zealand off to fantasy land with Amy Brenneman to Edie? And Michael Mann told me that, like, I always respected Robert De Niro and Michael Mann's, you know, obsessive, you know, crafting of that moment, but I didn't realize how obsessive. Like, they shot that over three nights, one scene. And they both agreed that they didn't get it for the two previous nights. Imagine whole nights of filming with just someone thinking on a camera driving. And so what it kind of did was just elevated the movie again in lots of strange ways. It was just wonderful.
Mann is that kind of ultra detail obsessed director. And I guess that is maybe answering the question I was saying earlier of, like, why Heat? Like, if there's somebody who's going to pack their film with enough ideas that you can keep thinking about every single minute, it's Michael Mann. And Heat itself is so dense. Like, when I rewatched Heat before recording this episode, and I was thinking something that I've heard people say on your show as well, that it really feels like it could be a TV show. Like, there's so much packed into it in terms of story, but also in terms of detail. You know, his consideration of the dynamics of how criminal groups would actually work, you know, the weapons, the psychology, that just the way that things sound, every single aspect of it has been labored over so much.
And, you know, you're so funny that you said how it sounds, because Michael Mann actually said this phrase to me, and I think this is something that I'll definitely, you know, when I'm trying to articulate, I guess, and what I think we're all trying to articulate in our love of cinema, that when movies really work, Michael Mann's like, everything talks. You know, he was describing everything in his frame, whether it's the actor, it's the emotion. It's the story that's being told. It's the music. It's the choice of lighting. It's the choice of frame. It's like everything talks. And, you know, and I've got to decide, like, where I turn the volume up, so to speak.
Right.
And so, but everything's talking. Like, there might be a prominent or a dominant thing happening in a scene or a space, but everything's talking. And so for him, that deep consideration of everything that's going on in the frame and everything that's happening in every shot, I just think sometimes, I don't know, it feels like a lost art. Like, that level of obsession is sometimes a lost art because, you know, we're in the Netflix generation, all of us, and, you know, there are many shows we watch on Netflix and you go, just kill three of those episodes. They didn't even need to be there, you know?
Yeah.
I just watched Stranger Things 3, I know what you mean.
Right, but yeah, just kill off that season entirely and it'll work.
But this is opening a whole can of worms, but I was going to say that's TV generally, you know, it's always too long.
Yeah.
It's nice to really celebrate a film that is this tight, that, you know, less is more. Even at 3 hours, heat really flies by.
Absolutely.
If you don't mind me asking, how many times have you actually watched Heat?
Look, I would have to say conservatively 250.
Wow.
Nice.
I would just say to you guys, like every episode, for every episode on the show, I didn't watch the whole film as I was preparing for every episode, but what I usually did was find the moment in the film that I was watching, and I'd watch about 10 minutes before and 10 minutes after. You just watch up to that minute and a few minutes beyond, but it was just about contextualizing the scene, what's happening in those moments, and, you know, the more and more that I dived into the show, the more and more very, very subtle, but very, very, very rich if you give it the time to check them out. There's great match cuts and really cool stuff that's going on. So I always try to watch 10 minutes either side. So imagine that, about 170 episodes, and I'm watching 20 minutes 170 times.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, it's plus whatever I'm watching in the, you know, and I've seen the movie twice in about the last 18 months at the cinema. So, you know, there's a lot of viewing of me in the last little while in my life.
Now, Chris asked the obvious question earlier, why Heat? I think the other obvious question is, you've seen this film more times than anyone, or as you possibly alluded to on the show, with the possible exception of Michael Mann. What in your, we have some different views on it in the studio, but what in your view is the best minute of Heat?
Oh, that's a great one, Glenn. I'd love to hear what you guys think. But look, I think it's very, very difficult for me to separate 2 minutes of the film, actually three. And I'll go with the third, which is probably more surprising, is there's a minute where Lillian, who is Dennis Haysbert's partner, he plays Don Breeden, looks up at the screen and sees that he's died in the film. It's kind of a side story. Post the heist, he's the driver who Robert De Niro enlists at the last moment when Danny Trejo's driver basically can't go along. You know, he's like, you know, they're on me like a cheap suit was his line. That is probably one of the most heartbreaking and resonant moments, because it's silence and you watch her feel the weight of all of her face just dissipate from her because she's disappointed that he's leaving. And that moment haunts me, I think. That right this minute is probably my third favorite. But the final 2 minutes, so minute 165 and 166, are the synthesis of the entire movie for me, of the themes of the movie. And, you know, I told you I was never going back is this sort of inimitable, you know, final line from Robert De Niro and Al Pacino saying, yeah. And that's in the 165. And then 166 features that great, you know, neon fresco of Pacino, De Niro up against the lights of the airport in LA, and I just can't separate that, because for me the kind of monumental weight of this movie all lands on those minutes. And so when I watch them, it's almost like my life, which is Heat, flashes before my eyes. And so I think that they're so profoundly great. What about you guys? I'd love to hear what your favorite minutes are.
That's tough. I again would say that it's hard to go past the ending. I did really like your third favorite minute. I love the way that Mann gives everyone, I guess except for Wayne Grow, and a few of the There's a few sleazeballs in there, but most everyone in Heat is afforded a lot of dignity and respect by Mann, and the way that that moment of violence, rather than just being a side story of, oh, one more guy got killed off, we get to see the story of him at the cafe being mistreated, and the commentary about how the system's broken and he feels forced into going back into crime. And, you know, Mann shows us the consequences of the violence. That's something that sticks with me in all of his films. He shows us really explicit violence, but there always seems to be a weight to it. It never feels like we're just in it for, you know, consequence-free glorifying it in, you know, dynamic bloodletting.
The fallout from that height takes more than 30 or 40 minutes.
Right.
You know, I would almost argue that the fallout of the heist takes us all the way to 166 minutes. Like, it is just consequence after, you know, things being cut loose and people dying and people being let go and people being forced into the choices that they didn't want to make, that they have to make.
Another minute I really like is early on when Waingrow executes the people in the armor guard van. The way that it's shut, the guy who can't hear because his eardrums have been blown out with the sort of dolly in on his face. It's such an affecting moment of tension being built.
Chris, you've stolen my favorite minute. Right. Thanks. Yeah, cool.
It's a great minute, Chris. It's a great minute. Both of you, Jeff. Those dead eyes.
Yeah.
Oh, those dead eyes in that hockey mask is unforgettable.
And it's remarkable how many films have attempted to copy this. I think The Town is one example of where Heat is a template or something to aspire to. And it just has, in so many respects, I can't think of examples where it's been equaled, whether it be the high sequence, whether
Dark
it be
Knight
the
is
images.
A,
yes.
Dark Knight is the most effective remake of Heat.
Right.
that is the most effective. There are plenty of others that don't. Yeah, I tend to agree. There are many others that I feel run with one thematic thread from Heat, thinking that that's what Heat is. And I think that the denser that this reading and this analysis has gotten, the more rich that it is. So it's like when they're trying to copy it, you know, there's a film critic in Oz, Cam Williams, who coined a phrase which I'll share with you guys called Heat blocking. And he said that if someone says this movie is inspired by Heat, you spend the rest of the movie being blocked by it and you just want to go home and watch Heat because it's so much better, clearly, than this movie that you kind of watch.
I mean, you're right, and part of it is the density of it, not in terms of just the content, but in terms of how much it is trying to do. And a lot of times I think we get caught up in films with big ideas who can't execute as much as just having big ideas, but the execution kind of falls flat. But with Heat, I think it's the perfect balance of big ideas, complex ideas, and the execution actually matching up to that, which is why it's so hard to just pick 1 minute. And actually going minute by minute is probably the best homage you can give it. Because every minute is kind of, you know, in itself something quite amazing.
Yeah, I mean, there was one key question that often comes up when people were doing the show or around the show is like, is there something going on in every minute? And I guess at the beginning, I naively was like, you know, expected, oh, surely there's one or so minutes that aren't that interesting. But there genuinely isn't. Like, every single minute has been dynamite. You know, even a car driving through a dilapidated and abandoned drive-in, you know, resulted in a 45-minute digression about post-apocalyptic landscapes and man's similarities to Lynch in that regard when it comes to LA as a sort of living but also post-apocalyptic landscape.
I see it.
So,
yeah, me too.
You know, it's so rich, so dense.
So it's strange to me. I remember seeing Heat not very long after it came out for the first time. I've watched it a few times since, and there were three moments that struck me the first time I watched it, which have always stayed with me and which remained with me. And these were moments that, before I was really into film or film criticism, that I thought, wow, these are the standout moments of the film, but they have not been as copied as some of the references that we've spoken about in this discussion. My second favorite moment is absolutely the final sequence, which you both referred to. I love, as an aside, probably my third favorite moment, the bit earlier in the film when Pacino's character knows that he's got, that De Niro's taking the photos of him and he's just thought he has the upper hand. And it's like, oh, no, wait, yep, all right, so it's this great cathartic moment of, yep, take this picture, so you got me.
So
but
Al Pacino is so priceless in this film.
Oh, it's so good. But my absolute standout moment, and I've seen people directors try to copy it, but it's absolutely never been matched, was the sequence for me where there's that slight noise and De Niro's character has to decide, do I go ahead with this?
That's
does
so good.
This happen? And it's this minute of the same shot of front on of each character, back and forth, mirror image. What do I do? Do I take this chance? Is this enough? How do I justify backing down to everyone around me? But I know the stakes and that decision to do it. It's such a powerful moment and I absolutely adore it.
Mm. Yeah, look, it's funny, Glenn, you just talked about two moments where there's great interactions where they don't actually share the screen that are almost as effective, if not more effective, than them actually sitting down at Kate Manolini's diner and talking, which is that these two titans sharing the screen or sharing the proximity to one another, and the energy is so electric that it overcomes infrared and that it overcomes distance and that it overcomes time, night, day, light, shade. It's incredible. And those spaces are so electric as well. So, like, they, you know, right then in that intimate moment, they couldn't be further away from each other, one another, technically, and they're like 10 meters apart from one another. And they couldn't be more intimate when they're hundreds of meters away in that other beautiful scene with the camera. Like, it's just, you want to know what they're looking at?
Yeah.
I almost start, like, doing the dialogue with you guys right now, and I just feel like I need to because I just love that scene so much, too. But yeah, there's just great moments where there's inferences of them being together. The energy is electric. And yeah, it's also restraint. You've got opportunities for them to face off.
I love.
You choose not to.
Right. I love also how Mann shows them being so aware of their environment. Like, we've just spoken about Macaulay noticing a sound ringing out. But there's also, you know, at the very end, Hannah noticing the shadow of Macaulay.
Yeah.
It's so cinematic as well, you know, how sound and light are the things that give away presences, and the characters are attuned to it, and it's instructing us as viewers to pay attention to all the little cinematic details. Actually, that final shootout really reminded me, watching it again, of the way Leone would shoot a shootout.
Absolutely.
Yeah, those close-ups.
Yeah, the wonderful close-ups of their faces, and especially that final framing of Pacino's face.
Mm-hmm.
Mann is a Leone fan too, and a Peckinpah fan.
Right.
And it's got a very, even the final episode, he describes the airport as like an alien landscape. It's a space not made for human beings, us bipedal things. He wanted it to be outside of the LA world that we're so familiar with. And I just feel like, you know, sometimes those desert spaces look like they're on a Martian landscape too. And so there's like romance of an airport, comings and goings, but there also is this alien space that's right there. It's not made for human beings, I think is his phrasing as a, and I just love that. I love that turn of phrase. I love that thought and that sentiment.
And it's pushing people out to the boundaries, like the classic image of man characters staring out at the ocean, right at the edges of existence.
Yeah, staring into the sublime. You know, they can't escape their programming. It's one of those things, and I think that's what, you know, we all, one of the great things about a man hero is that they're deeply relatable. You know, these are people that are obsessed with doing their jobs well. And sometimes they're willing to sacrifice family time and courtesy and cordiality to do that. And that's deeply relatable thing. And obviously it's amplified to the dramatic and sometimes melodramatic when you talk about the consequences being criminal, you know, life and death. But I think that's what's also deeply relatable. Like coming home late to your partner because you've been out late pursuing the thing that gives you, that you've prescribed to give your life meaning, and messing it up or sacrificing not having a partner because you feel like it's going to impinge on what your dream is, and then realizing like, what am I doing with my life? Is this actually enriching me, or is it torturing me? These are great questions.
So I think it's going to be hard for people not listening to this to not go search Chat Heat. I do want to see it again. And to also not listen to your show. Dude, where is it? Where can we all find it? Where can we track it down?
The best place you can find it is just go to oneheatminute.com. We've got links to all the relevant podcast app sites that everyone uses, or just go to your podcasting app and type in One Heat Minute. And you've got a good 170-odd episodes of listening to enjoy. So I'd love you guys to listen to it. Reach out. If you love the show, at Blake is Batman on Twitter, and hit me up, or just hashtag One Heat Minute, and we'll find it. And love to be engaged with everyone about the show.
Well, please do reach out. And dude, congratulations on such a monumental achievement, and not just this weekend, but the last few years, and even having the idea of, and the gumption and the courage to put it together. It's incredible.
And also just personally as well. I mean, congratulations on your son turning one. That's big thing. Yeah.
But yes.
Thank you. It has been a monumental weekend, and he has no idea about why his dad was his phone was melting down on the weekend. but one day I'll explain. Thank you so much. I can't thank you guys enough for having me on, and I can't thank the amazing people that have helped me get it here. And it's just been one incredible journey that I'm just so glad is now complete for people to hear, and with that towering ending, it's just it's a real treat. So it was a treat for me, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that was Blake Howard from One Heat Minute, talking all things about the phenomenal and incredible milestone in his now completed podcast. And now we are discussing all things Booksmart. This is the feature debut from director Olivia Wilde, and it is starring Beanie Feldstein and Caitlin Dever, and it is in cinemas tomorrow. It is the story of two young women on the cusp of graduation who haven't really partied a lot. They're book smart, and they're going to spend their final night before graduation seeking out that elusive high school party. If this sounds like another film that was very popular about 12 years ago, you're not wrong. It is very similar, and I will say derivative of in many respects. It is its own film too, in many other respects.
Superbad is that film.
Yes. If you haven't seen that, go out and see that now and see it first.
Yeah, the coincidence, quotation marks,
coincidence
of this connection to Superbad is made weirder because arguably the lead of the film, Beanie Feldstein, is the sister of Jonah Hill, arguably the lead of Superbad.
And filling the same characters.
She's the same character, one who wants to party.
And the Deva character is the equivalent very much of the Michael Cera character. Certainly it's a different trajectory, but there are some similar tidbits. The a prominent sequence involving a car, the involvement of the police force.
Yeah.
And
school principal, everything is derivative.
A lot of it's like Superbad.
But people have forgotten that Emma Stone wasn't Superbad, so I guess people do have a very short public memory.
So she just wasn't a star when Superbad came out, so people don't that Emma Stone movie, Superbad.
One was really big in that movie, but that launched a lot of people.
Jonah Hill had been in Knocked Up the same year, and Michael Cera,
knew Michael Cera.
George Michael.
Yeah. Weird that Michael Cera was the biggest draw of Superbad, think about it.
We talk about Superbad, we should talk about this movie. We're going to talk a lot about what we... things we think are detractions. Certainly there's been a lot of hype over this. I'd like to start, however, with what I enjoyed about the film, and that is that the two leads, every scene where it's just the two of them and they're allowed to play off each other, is very, very good. They have a great dynamic. They have an intrinsic dynamic. They have a dynamic that is emblematic of one that could only transpire from having spent years and most of your life as close and inseparable friends. That is certainly very apparent here. There are any number of their encounters, some of their idiosyncrasies as they meet or greet each other. The trolling of one of the characters' parents, played by Lisa Kudrow and Will Fortately. So one of the characters' trolling is very funny. The best scene in the film is a later confrontation with involving the two characters, where some of it's just Olivia Wilde, who does a decent job in many respects, is allowed to just pan between the two and just lets the camera settle on them. And in this sequence, Dimmy, and sometimes the dialogue takes center stage, sometimes it doesn't, and you're left with an impression of what is said and what is done. And that, for me, worked very well. I know there are other aspects of this which this film did not.
Okay, I'll take from your lead and talk about what I liked about it. I think this is really carried by the performers. especially Benny Feldstein, who is very funny. I think there's a pretty likable spirit to it because it's rooted in this female friendship, which I think does feel realistically not portrayed, not overplayed, it's believable, it's warm. And I think, like I said before, the performers are all really good. They really elevate the material, is my backhanded compliment. What did you think, Virat?
Well, it's not really that good. But
all right, here we go. No, it's not.
Okay. The problem is, and part of the problem, and I think this problem is exacerbated with how much of the material is trying to contextualize in the current political climate of how films ought to be made, in how they look in terms of their morality. So this film is trying very hard to tick all the boxes in kind of a checklist manner of what a woke comedy, a young woke comedy, ought to look like. And I don't think it does a good job precisely because I think it is trying to look like a woke comedy rather than just trying to be funny most of the time. And when the characters are allowed to be funny and play off each other, you're right, they are genuinely funny. But most of the material is so dragged down by the sort of external sort of facets of what the script is wanting the characters to do rather than the characters actually just allowing themselves to be on screen. I think that's the problem.
Okay, I don't know if I entirely agree with this. And if we're talking about the film as a piece of woke representation, one of the things we have to look to the film is representation of certain characters, and particularly minorities. And one of the main characters in this film is queer. Now, you could make the argument, and this, I'm implying this is necessarily what you were going for, but this is, if people who wanted to make that argument would often look to this depiction in the film. I don't think the film, the film depicts this character as queer. It's not, they don't make a big point of it. They don't put the whole film around it. It's just a fact of this character. It's just a simple, I remember we talked about this something in a completely different context, something about Mary some time ago, how there was that scene where they smoked a joint and it was
it's no
big deal. And it's not treated as a big deal in this film. Therefore, I don't think it's going for woke points so much as simply, at least in this respect, representing an aspect of our culture.
Okay. I agree that representing a queer character and queer relationships as just a normal thing in the same way that a high school rom-com, a high school raunchy comedy would portray heteronormative relationships is a good thing.
Yeah.
But I can see where Virat is coming from on a general note that this film looks to be, is going for woke points. And this manifests itself in positive ways. Like, for the most part, the humor in this is not very mean-spirited, and a lot of less woke high school comedies of the past, I think, you know, have a bit of an ugly streak to them.
It doesn't pursue easy stereotypes or mean stereotypes. No. It doesn't take derogatory shots at any characters.
But maybe once you turn on this kind of cynicism that Virat and perhaps myself as well have approached the film with, you start to think, okay, oh, you know, it's great that you've got, like, moments where we take time out to talk about, like, saying take time out is maybe being a little bit harsh, but it's like, now we're going to talk about female body representation. Now we're going to talk about my body, my rights. Now, you know, look at how I've got a Free Palestine sign in my room. Like, there's all these window dressing elements that don't really have anything to do with the narrative per se, but they're just there to show, like, look at how progressive we are. And, you know, there's another...
Or even the recurring gag calling him Malala, which is, you know, once again...
That was funny.
That was funny.
Again, a lot of the idiosyncrasies which were distinct to this film. I mean, we just got that. We knew what they were saying. We got it.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem with that is, look, I'm not saying to say it's emblematic for a certain kind of upper sort of, you know... Or maybe that is what the milieu is, where they are so in tune with the kind of woke politics, where they can make a joke like, oh, I'm calling a Malala, without recognizing the irony of the joke itself, which is like, you know, she didn't get to do what she wanted. You know, it's not...
We should clarify that calling Malala means that you get to do this once in a while, where you basically, I've asked you to do something, you just have to do it.
But look, this is a movie where one of the characters, this is treated not as a joke. one of the characters is going to Botswana to help make tampons, and that's not treated as a parody of liberal do-gooders.
I know,
rich, wealthy, privileged people, coming to be help. It should be portrayed as parody.
Exactly. Excuse me. I've spent quite a bit of time in Botswana, and you know the folks there. They need a lot of aid and a lot of support. So I high five. Hands up for that.
Look, that's what I'm trying to say. I'm confused about this kind of the placement, the contextual placement of these messages that come across. Are they ironic to the extent where even the characters realize how completely stupid they come across in some of these scenes? Or is it like, you know, a self-aware high five where like, we know we're from this milieu, hence we can joke about it. I don't think you're right, Chris. I don't think the characters are portrayed
It's just
that
maybe
way.
That there's just a whole lot of these things. Like, we're also going to have a, you know, scene in a unisex bathroom and a character talking about why that's a good thing. Like, it's there's so many things, like, pat on the back, look at how left-wing we are.
But it's all this white liberal feminism, which kind of just kind of wants me to, you know, put a whatever compass in my eye kind of feel. Anyway.
Compass in my eye.
Wow.
Look, these things I didn't think were particularly a bad thing, and I think it's getting off track from what are the bad things about the film.
These are pretty accurate representations of how people... The fact that there was a scene in a unisex bathroom and that this is not generally portrayed or depicted in cinema, any cinema, or American cinema to boot, is remarkable, and it led to, and one of the best sequences in the film, is characters confront each other about matters entirely distinct from the location and perceptions of how, separate from issues of representation, how the book, quote-unquote book-smart characters viewed the others in their school. On the matter, you refer to the signs as an example, things in their rooms as signals of what these characters
are. And the bumper stickers on their cars.
My favorite thing about this film is it was a little touch where you can blink and you'll miss it, and it's on the main character's room. It's a sign saying "a room of one's own," and it's this incredible.
That was a good touch.
And it was such a distinct, clever. It signals, it says this is what this character is, much more than, and I will give you the much more generic stuff that was on the bumper stickers. So I think I understand what they were going for. I think there were times where they did it very well, and I think there were times when it was generic and didn't lend these characters any interest that otherwise could have had if it had gone for anything more in more particular detail.
When I say these things are window dressing, I mean, what exactly is the relevance to the general narrative of the character having these particular political beliefs? It's basically just there
nothing.
To it's
Absolutely
there to, it's
nothing.
There to
exactly.
to get the it's worked because we've got critics falling over themselves saying that this quite plain, quite generic high school comedy is like a masterpiece. Liberals, like, you know, people like us have film critics tend to be quite left wing.
Yeah.
They've successfully gamed the system to get those people on side to an aspect which is tangential to the actual material of the film, really.
It's exactly like Bradley Whitford's character in Get Out saying, "I would have voted for Obama a second time if I could." Third time, actually. That's right. So it's exactly that sentiment, because I think you're right. A lot of it, especially, let's say, you know, that room of one.
The movie's not about their politics.
Yeah. A Room of One's Own with Virginia Woolf. I mean, it's a great reference. I get that. But at the same time, I feel like, where is that going? It's not even...
That's showing how literary that these people love literature literary perspective.
And insular, as reflected in the themes of the book.
Right, yeah.
So that on many levels that worked, which is why I give that props. But I appreciate that. Which tells a lot about the character. Other things that we were that's supposed to signal this what this character is didn't in the way that they could have or should have.
Okay, let's move into the actual narrative, because, you know, for whatever window dressing it is, the actual narrative is quite generic. It's hitting some certain beats it's supposed to hit. So, from a narrative perspective, I was so frustrated because I was like, this is just like every Judd Apatow movie, which he did when he was actually good.
You need to detract points from this film, I think, for it being so familiar and so based on the template of a pre-existing film. There is just that sense of familiarity. I don't think the obviously some people will disagree, but I don't think changing it to a feminine perspective transcends that. I think it definitely adds something new, because Superbad is really defined by horny boys.
Yeah.
But this has quite a different feel.
And we'll respond like to a different audience.
Yeah, but I don't see how that can be entirely looked past. the critical response to this film has been strange to me.
There's nothing in the actual narrative template which is trying something new or fresh or trying to subvert expectations, apart from the fact that now we have just played with the template insofar as these kind of window dressing points. If they're to be taken literally, then that's the point, but I don't think they're doing much with it, which is kind of the problem.
So turning to the narrative aspects of the film and some of its biggest attractions, I referred earlier to how my favorite thing about this is when the two leads, the two very good leads, are able to just play off each other. The problem is any sequence which does not involve the two of them playing off each other pivot to one tired form of humor, which is the two of them being very nonplussed as some exaggerated crazy happenstance, usually involving one other character or more, happens in front of them, whether it be the scene with Jason Sudeikis, the principal, playing out of the car, which admittedly was quite funny, or some of the other sequences that took place on the boat. A couple work in isolation. When you constantly have this one recurring form of humor, it becomes boring.
What sort of humor are you referring to?
The one where it's the... they stand in the background and they have to watch and react.
Some dude being wacky.
Yeah, something crazy happens.
Well, yeah, you're touching on one of my big issues with the humor in this film, which I think is an issue with most recent American mainstream comedy, which is just that it's way too over the top.
Yeah.
But in this film, it's a bit of an issue because this film tries to go for more serious material later on, and I don't think it easily coexists with the wackiness. This movie goes like really way out there in terms of how over the top it's the side characters are and some of the plot points are, then goes to like now it's serious.
The change in tone is so jarring.
And then right back to craziness.
This is actually the biggest problem in the film. You look at films like teen classics, American Pie, 10 Things Ahead About You, well, there's a lot of wackiness and it's fun to watch. Then the film plateaus in terms of its dramatic effect to deliver some actual emotional beats and sustains
that.
Did you
just call American Pie a teenage classic?
It is. It absolutely is. It's a very 20th anniversary coming out next month.
Okay.
It's an excellent film, and it was never equaled even close by any of the terrible sequels. Now, with regard to you saw them go for some sincere moments at the end, whether it be on prom night or later. This pivots to that in the third act, and that's fine. But when you have a semi-fourth act where we just have to go back to the craziness, it doesn't land.
Send everyone home happy with the good spirits of wacky Booksmart.
But it gets worse when you have to rely on really stupid plot points to get a character from point A to B, which we can't ruin. We don't want to ruin
movie's already gone to a serious place. It's like, oh, we're back to this. And it doesn't carry out those tonal shifts. I think it's actually just a pretty bad script in a number of ways. Like early on in the film, I've alluded to earlier that I said that this is really a character carried piece. But early on I was thinking, hang on, the jokes are coming thick and fast, but not many of them are actually funny. But there's the feeling that it's funny because the actors are funny. Watching them, you know, go through the motions is funny, but the material isn't that good. But it's bad on a number of levels.
I mean, part of the problem with this film, especially what it does with the material, is we're supposed to believe these are wacky characters, but there's not much physical comedy happening, which is kind of a loss.
Oh, there is, and it's goddamn terrible, but I'll get to that later.
Plenty of physical comedy. Yeah, and the claymation.
I'll get to that. I can go all day on that.
I wouldn't call that physical comedy, except bad attempts at physical comedy, which is not funny. And because when I was watching it, I felt like, is this what... are they trying to be funny? Because I wasn't sure whether they were trying to be funny.
Look, they definitely are. But when I say this is a bad script, I think there's just moments that jump out at me and think, like, hang on, this wouldn't happen. Like, even the basic premise of the film, the whole idea is that the Benny Feldstein character Molly is obsessed with academic performance super competitive. I've been in that environment. There's no way that character would be blindsided by realizing that people around her are actually geniuses who are going to elite universities.
I know.
That character would be on that. There's
I know.
No, the premise of this movie is that she's surprised to find out that they were actually as good at academically as her while also going to parties, and she feels like she's missed out because she's been the book smart but socially isolated person. And so she has a meltdown and has to go to all the cool parties to be as good as them.
Okay, I'm going to make a distinction. I feel it could have worked if it had betrayed her, like the Caitlin Dever character's insula. However, it makes the point that the Bernie Feldstein character is hyper-competitive.
Exactly.
And is the school captain and it takes it incredibly seriously.
Yeah, there's but no way she could have been blindsided by academic performance that good by all of her
people
peers.
She's known for 12 years.
Exactly. No way. I mean, and she's like getting all up in their face in the early scenes where we see how she...
Which
which is a response fairly to how badly she was gossiped about, right? Well, no, I didn't think she was there.
Yeah.
But she would have had an inkling that these aren't all, you know, getting C's and D's.
Yeah, yeah. It's a dumb premise, but, you know, okay.
But part of the problem with the movie is just that, where things happen for no rhyme or reason to get people from one situation to another situation, where basically they're just, you know, placeholders for wacky things to occur to these characters as they look on. And they try to be the voices of reason in a wacky environment, which kind of gets boring really quickly from, let's say, a party sequence at a house to a boat to then back to another sequence. You know, it just feels like the location change happens and here we are at a new location with some other wacky people doing wacky things before we're back to, you know, a new location.
But it worked in Superbad, and it worked because there was spatial awareness of the small town where they're in and getting from A to B. They're just able to get from places and they make it very quickly. They're able to fly. And they make a joke about if one character is able to magically transport between places.
I found that to be...
I liked that. I thought it was funny. But they laid a little too heavy on it later in the show.
Yeah, but isn't it just revealing how flimsy the script is and trying to make it into a joke?
Yeah.
But I didn't mind it when it was the haphazard, crazy antics which characterized the first two thirds of this movie.
But then it becomes serious and delivers a serious speech near the end.
Yes, and then it returns to the crazy antics when it should not have maintained it since and should have maintained its sincere posture.
Okay, so going back to what Virat said, I'll call attention to Superbad because, you know, the movie
it's hard not to.
You can't.
Superbad, it has wacky kind of sequences, but they follow through. Like the meeting in the police in the McLovin scene turns into a whole subplot of the film.
I know
that
it's
explains
amazing.
Where that character
and,
goes.
And the callbacks are like, you know, it becomes part of the fabric of the narrative.
Apart from a pretty weak callback near the end, that goes into this general issue we're talking about of going too over the top. For the most part, it's just kind of like one and done with these sequences. They're fairly disconnected from each other. But in relation to that, they experience one, you know, wacky scene at which moves them to the next location. There was one aspect of this, which is... look, I was reminded of this Howard Hawks quote while I was watching it, which is that a good movie has three good scenes and no bad ones. And this movie has a scene which is just so atomically bad that, like, I can't see how you can say this
Claymation.
Is a great film. Yes. All right. Okay. I'll talk about this. The idea of characters accidentally ingest drugs and then there's wacky comedy that ensues has been done so many times before. It's such a bad cliche that if you're going to do it, you have to do it pretty well. It's like a Hitler joke, right? if you're going to do that, you better have something good.
It has to be Taika Waititi playing Hitler.
Mel Brooks, you know. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Taika, that's a
which
fresh
is, which
one.
Is on so many levels, it's just great.
Right, exactly. So I was waiting for this to happen from the moment that a character, you know, the girl who magically disappears and reappears, shoved strawberries in the character's mouths and said, "Eat the strawberries." I thought, okay, so there's going to be a drug bit. So I was waiting for it to happen. So there's that extra level of expectation because the joke wasn't well masked enough. What eventuates is so goddamn terrible. They become... all right, they were told that they ingested an Asian version of ayahuasca. Asian-huasca, okay? All right, so for a moment, I'll suspend my disbelief and buy that there's a drug out there that can make you believe that, you know, that you're both dolls. But the material in the claymation scene that follows is not funny at all. Strip it. It's ridiculous as far as like a drug thing, obviously, because as me and Glenn said when we saw it, drugs don't work.
Kids don't take drugs.
Yeah.
And that's not how
that's
drugs
not
work.
How drugs
but
work.
Also,
but even
if Glenn can say that that's not how drugs work, look, then if, you really need to know if, it's really bad.
But strip it from the drug context, right? And the scene would just be plain unfunny. In any context, it's funny because we are now dolls and we comment on wow, it's sexist that dolls are shaped this way. Oh, look, I'm sexy now. Like, it wasn't particularly funny or clever.
But then part of the problem when the politics come and flimsily, right?
It's a message scene which says you can get over drug use very quickly within a matter of an hour if you never used drugs
okay,
before.
Okay, so I'm thinking, okay, I'm suspending my disbelief, I shouldn't, that there's a drug out there that does this to your mind, but when they leave the scene, they immediately go back to the normal kind of patter of conversation.
To drive.
Yeah, they're able to drive afterwards. After they've
not
just
too,
gone
not
on
too
something
long afterwards, yeah.
That mind-bending. And immediately afterwards, they're like, they go back to the same way that the dialogue was written prior to this scene, where they're like, all right, we've gone to a party, we've done drugs, let's just go home. And it's like, come on. Like, if your mind's been through that kind of experience, I'm thinking you're going to be a little bit altered
clearly,
on the other end.
Yeah,
call
clearly,
Will Forte and yeah. Lisa Kudrow.
They go from being, like, that high to being, like, right back to normal, like, 15 minutes later. Like...
It, clearly shows that the scriptwriters and Olivia Wilde have no experience of what doing actual drugs feels like.
But it was just so hacky and so lazy and not funny. And it calling attention to itself, like in the shift to the animation style, it's like it was meant to be a big centerpiece scene of the film. And the thing is...
But look...
The main thing is it's not funny. Like people will say, oh, this is a comedy movie, lighten up, you're taking it way too seriously. But jokes have to be believable within the context of the world. There was another example of a joke like this later in the movie where, just quickly, the characters are wearing matching clothes and they ride in the back of someone else, a car, and she's like, oh, I've got some spare clothes. Why don't you change into these, right? And then the characters both change into another woman's spare clothes. And immediately when she announced she had spare clothes in the back of the car, I thought, oh, are they in the right size? And then it turns out that they're in the right size for both of them. But this is the comic, the classic comedy duo of the skinny, taller one and the fatter, short one. And yet they both have clothes that fit them. Like
And the teacher is significantly taller not as the shape or size of
exactly
any
it's
of these characters.
Like a joke needs to be, it can be wacky, it can be outrageous, but
the setup needs to be believable for you to land the punchline.
Otherwise, because when the punchline came, I couldn't even register it as comedy. I was just going,
yeah,
like what?
WTF kind of thing.
What?
Yeah. The part of the problem, and you've hit the nail on the head, is that how to. Film treats its own politics, and you know this idea when the narrative finds it convenient, the politics is just inserted into it, especially in the claymation scene, for example, not for comedy but for scoring these wacky brownie points, like look how woke
we
can be.
We made a comment
be.
On women's
look, we
representation
made...
in dolls, okay,
you know, but like
you want to see a good version of how this is done and much more nuanced, watch the Black Mirror episode USS Callister, where the individuals are reimagined in fantasy.
That was way better
without genitals,
totally.
And in this terrible dude's mind, and again, it goes into much more detail. This did not.
But that's my problem, you know.
Good call.
If you want to make a film with politics and comedy, and you know how they interact, actually commit to it. And this is the problem with
the
film.
Well, this movie has six writers, and it reportedly was in development. I'm pretty sure it's six. It's either four or six, but it was in development for a very long time. I'm wondering if this is something that's literally just been added onto the project. A lot of the political references.
It kind of feels like it, and you know.
Don't relate to the core structure.
Yeah, it tries so hard to be current, and so many of these characters have such goddamn first world problems. I was just so sick of them. I'm just like, you know, okay, fine. You're upper middle class and white people. You're allowed to have problems, but gosh,
not everyone in the film is white and upper middle class or upper class.
But
they have
white,
like,
upper middle
class
problems.
Look at how rich
everyone
in this movie is.
No, they have white upper middle class problems,
except for Molly.
Yeah, that's right. Except for Molly. But even she co-opts and tries. The problems she has are basically that. So I'm just talking about the milieu and the environment. The fact that everyone is going to a elite private school.
Is it a private school?
Okay,
it's
elite universities.
It's a public. No,
sorry,
they're at a public school, but they're all going to elite universities.
Elite universities, the big eight.
There's a guy who's like mega stoner with like the
he's
long...
He's going to work
for
Google.
He's being hired straight out of high school for like $200,000 a year.
That happens.
No one in this school is just the stoner or just the popular loser. Like, they're all actually geniuses.
It probably just had...
Secretly.
And they're all this one place at this one time.
Yeah, like, would the movie... The movie is about the lesson to, like, accepting that these people are great, but would the filmmakers view them as great if they weren't super geniuses? Are they really great on their own terms?
Which is part of why I think Superbad worked, because they had, you know... They were actually losers, you know?
I think... Okay, I'm going to qualify your criticism, or at least in my view. Yes, I agree, this is a film... in large respects about first world people with first world problems, but you know what? There's a market for that, and there's first world people with first world problems. Look, all it means, it's not a problem with the film, it just means it'll be less accessible and less endearing than a lot of other films. Again, we're referencing Superbad, but it's absolutely true. This will have a much wider audience for good reason.
Look, Olivia Wilde is portraying what she knows, probably. She comes from an background of extreme wealth.
Yeah. Look, I'm not saying that there is not an audience for this kind of film. That's fine. But the problem with it is how callous it is with its own material. Mm. I mean, you know, you can be okay, and you can actually be sensitive to its own portrayal. And when the tone shift happens, there is a dialogue between Molly and, you know, one other character where they do talk about the perils of trying to be maintaining an image. And it does try to make some kind of sincere point. But these moments are so few and far between this sort of hackneyed mesh of a thing where people are so, you know, they're trying to outscore each other. Actually, the film is symptomatic, the script is symptomatic of all these people and how they behave with each other. They're just trying to outscore points. And the film is trying to do that with the audience. It's trying to, like, outpoint you by saying, hang on, you think we didn't include this reference, but we've already got it here. And that's why we win a point for this. You know, and you got to give us a point for this as well, because we are so woke, and all these people, they have real issues, man. They want to save the world. They want to save poor people in Botswana, and we should get a point for that too.
They should get a point for that.
God damn it, you should laugh at this because this is also funny. And if you don't find it funny,
we should be encouraging people like that, not laughing at them.
No, exactly. But that's the point. This movie is almost forcing you to say you should find this kind of humor funny, and if you don't, there's something wrong with you. So you should recalibrate your own sense of humor. And that I find a bit offensive.
I don't think it's doing that at all. I think it's just appealing to a particular audience. I think it's trying to appeal to a wide audience while, yes, and there are some woke points it goes for, but at the end...
This entire movie is just like a checklist
but
of
But again, though,
there's plenty of other woke elements they could have gone for should they have wished to. We've talked... I want to talk about one scene, which I actually really liked, and it is a strange moment among a longer sequence which was really ebbed and flowed, and that was the pool scene. Because, and I referenced earlier the confrontation scene, which became dialogue-free. The pool scene is another scene which is dialogue-free. They could have filled this with explanations of here's how the character's feeling now, as is very much the case in John Hughes comedies. However, in the sequence, they just decided, no, we're going to have a visual representation of this. And it was the most gorgeous cinematography of the film. I really like that. It's strange to me that a film where the best parts you can point to are all the bits involving the two main characters. The only other really good bits are the bits that are really good bits, are the bits that are dialogue-free.
I think the other characters aren't particularly fleshed out. I think you're right that it takes off when it's trying to take you inside the perspective of the main characters. And also the dynamics of their relationship. But the issue with the side characters is, again, going back to this idea of everything being way too over the top, the mechanics of the film become too apparent because characters are introduced just as a joke, you know? Like for example, the rich guy who holds the pool party, he's just, like, completely wacky. Or the popular girl who has a mean nickname associated with her. These characters basically exist to be derided by the filmmakers early on. And then until it's the point in the narrative where they have
the redemption arc happens
and they have to be taken seriously. So suddenly they sit down and they start presenting speeches about the lessons we should be learning.
Oh, there's so much speechifying in this movie.
That immediate transition for not one but two characters, maybe more, it just reveals the hand of the writers way too much, and it's not a tonal shift that I think is owned.
Amy's arc in terms of, you know, even her exploration of sexuality is also kind of backhandedly, I guess, it kind of took me by surprise in the sense I was just like, wait, what? Mm-hmm. You know, this is how you're going to deal with it? Because they try to go for a sincere point and, you know, an emotional comeuppance, and then comeuppance is a weird word choice, but just an emotional moment, I should say. And I was just like, hang on. And then it's just completely brushed aside, and then you moved on to, no, hang on, you know, now we found the resolution kind of happens.
The romantic resolutions are way too easy in this.
I absolutely agree with that. And it's sort of a similar criticism I have of Superbad, actually, one of the few criticisms I have of Superbad. I have a problem with Amy's arc as regards to how she was discovering or coming to terms with sexuality. And for reasons I referenced earlier, I think that's actually one of the better parts of the film. With regards to the two characters, the rich guy, and the girl who has the terrible name, I actually took an entirely different view on this film. I don't think they're going through redemption arcs at all.
I think they are pointing out that you look at the way these characters are portrayed in our first encounters and our later encounters with them, and there's not that much of a dissimilarity. All we do is divorce ourselves to some extent from the narrow viewpoint of the main characters and how they view these individuals. And it's pointing out, wait a minute, these characters who we've come to know, who hold themselves up and who are book smart and who are learned, they also have their own prejudices, just like others may have prejudices of them. I actually quite like that.
On paper, I agree with that. It's just that it's such a manipulative and easy way to do it to... I don't think we can say it's just the film is allied with the perspective of seeing these people as a joke, because they're so outrageously wacky and over the top in their portrayal that there's no way watching the film you're going to take these characters as anything but a joke until they suddenly reveal themselves as not being so. It's just like too manipulative, and like I said, you can see the gears of the script turning too much.
Yeah.
It's just a sudden transition.
I would say that's for the very rich character, even though I think he's still a very sympathetic character. I would not say that for the character who had a terrible nickname. She was portrayed very consistently throughout.
The thing about this whole dynamic, though, is I wonder who was mean first? She's basically, they seem to be like a mean characters who are always trashing Molly's character.
Yeah.
Like, is it necessarily so bad that she holds her, you know, holds them to a degree of contempt if they've made her school life hell to some degree?
No, but they're both lousy characters in a
exactly.
lot of ways.
They are, yeah. But I'm not saying
that... watching a lot of people who are incredibly flawed.
I'm not saying that Molly's a great character. I'm just saying that this whole premise of like learning that they're great is like... Can they also not learn that she's great and that she should be valued for being book smart? You know,
I mean, part of this script is how it's manipulative. Mm-hmm. Part of the problem with the script is how it's manipulative and how it tries to align you with the perspective of Molly and Amy because of how, you know, people are supposedly mean to them. But yet nothing
people
about...
Are mean.
Okay, yeah, fine.
At least to Molly. We don't really...
People
do we
are,
see
are, yes, okay.
We don't really see people being Amy, mean to people Amy, definitely though. Seem to be mean to Molly, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it seems to ignore Amy.
Yeah, but is
which is, I guess, in its own sense, like, meanness.
To what extent, like, it's kind of a strange perspective because, like, with what I was saying before, like, to what extent is the way that Molly acts a defense mechanism she's built up? You know, but the whole thing is like she has to learn that everyone around her is actually also great.
But also, like,
it's a bit of a strange perspective.
Yeah, there's nothing she does or you know acts, especially in the beginning or you know the formative part of the film, which makes you to believe that you know you can side with her, even though other people are mean to her. You know, she's like, well, she's not really.
She's wacky.
Yeah, she's
funny.
Also,
she's
but also like because we're seeing the entire film through their eyes, we're somehow supposed to believe that other characters are more wacky than them. Except these two characters are pretty wacky themselves.
You know what gets me, and I think it was missing from the movie. The one thing we don't get, we spend so much time with Amy's parents. We have no conception of Molly's parents or her background or how she grew up or what her environment she lives in. And she may very well be a product or reacting to that. I would like to have known that. I'm sure the filmmakers and the performers had this in mind, but we are given absolutely no context to this. It is a problem in the film.
Especially because the film points out that she comes from a less wealthy perspective and she seems to be surrounded by people at this high school who are really, really wealthy. So... To what extent is this thing of I have to be superior to everyone academically a thing she's built up just because of a perceived inferiority?
I think you're already trying to...
And this can be comedy. Yeah, this can be portrayed as comedy.
Exactly. And
this isn't too serious for the film.
Lady Bird kind of did that, I guess.
I was thinking of Lady Bird,
But that's the thing.
It doesn't need to be as serious as Lady Bird. But you can approach these aspects because I think the film does want to some degree have realistic character dynamics especially towards the end. And I think this kind of thing can be touched upon and still play as a comedy.
Yeah, which is what I'm not sure about, whether or not the film actually is serious about the kind of metatextual commentary it's trying to make about what kind of character dynamics and socioeconomic status people come from. Because it's just like, is it just there to kind of, you know, as a peripheral point of view, or are we actually trying to engage with these points and issues, or they're just there because they're just there for the heck of it? I was never quite sure what the film was wanting to do with these points of view, and part of that is that kind of half-baked characterization.
Man, I just don't think the jokes are that good.
That's,
like everything,
that's okay, yeah.
everything, it, all of this would be transcended if it had really
if
good
the
jokes.
Film was actually funny.
There's a few funny ones.
When they're together, the panda bit was pretty funny.
It was pretty good. That was very like American Pie-esque. Like it was very like classic teen, you know, 90s teen sex comedy kind of vibe.
Lisa Kudrow, Will Forte nailed basically all their scenes.
They were funny. Some of the stuff with the parents actually in general was funny.
I referenced the meet and greet where they're doing these signs at each other, and yeah, that was good. Again, it should have just been the two of them and watch them grow.
When it goes super wacky, it's not that funny. Like the kind of derisive attitude to the side characters, like I think you see that in the stuff about the drama nerds, where they're basically just a big joke about, like, look at how flamboyant and over the top they are.
Riverdale have done this, Glee have done this, High School Musical has done this.
And in a movie about, like, learning how everyone, that's meant to be progressive and learning how everyone's great, it was basically...
It's very, very Chris Lilly-like, actually. I was thinking Mr. G. Yeah, I was thinking so much like Mr. G from...
God,
yeah,
Mr. G.
Yeah, I know. Is he cancelled yet?
It was basically like, But in this film, it was basically like, oh, look at how annoying these drama nerds are. That was basically their role. It was like, look at how just goddamn annoying they are.
It was the most generic aspect of the movie.
If anything, that seems to go against the message of this movie about learning how everyone's great.
Unless
you're too gay.
But no.
You're only allowed to be just gay enough, like Amy.
But that's also part of the kind of, white liberal feminism where, you try to be like, okay, cool, this is the extent, this is the bar, and you can't cross it.
Again, are all the characters white in this film? I don't know.
I'm saying that I'm talking about the film's politics, and the film's politics are definitely white liberal feminism and like trying to score points like that. I will die by that sword.
Another bad joke, like the stuff about, oh God, I don't know if I can talk about this without spoiling it, but there's a thing about identifying a criminal in this, which is just like
We did reference it earlier. It's just, and it was the lowest point of when they switched up the tone back to the wackiness, and it's just the shrug, come on, how could you go there moment. You could have gotten out of this circumstance in any other number of more creative ways.
Yeah.
It's just lazy storytelling.
But it's also like these twists, like the drug thing earlier, these twists are kind of too telegraphed. Like after that, the initial encounter with this character, I was like, okay, it was so awkwardly... on the nose how he talks.
Oh, you'd be like, oh, it has to be shady, right?
Yeah, something's got to come out of this.
Oh, again, I actually thought the twist was quite good. I just wish it had come in the second act when it would have been more entertaining.
Right, yeah.
When it would have
worked. Yeah, right, it came at a bad point.
Yeah.
And like, it's like at the... there's a scene near the end after we're building up a serious moment, and like, instead of... okay, we have to get to a place quickly. So instead of just showing, urgent people in a car, we've got to show the most over the top thing with like this car veering across traffic and almost killing people. It's not portrayed as almost killing people in the cut in the movie, but Matt, if you were driving like this, you're almost killing people. It's just like the tone slips away from her, like because she's trying to go so wacky and crowd pleasing all the time, and it's not necessary.
Go Need for Speed, yeah.
But yeah, I look, the movie, I've been so critical, but the movie is like broadly enjoyable. Because the actors are good.
I'd say go see it simply for the two leads and the scenes where they are allowed just to work magic off each other.
If you're into this kind of thing,
yeah.
I mean,
when it's out on like video on demand or like on SBS World Movies Channel, watch it on Fast Forward. Or
good,
something.
Good prop. We haven't spoken about the launch of SBS Forward. World Movies Channel.
Yeah, I was segue to something I actually like.
I watched five Studio Ghibli movies this weekend. I was so happy. I'd seen three new ones.
What were the new ones?
The new ones were Ponyo, Laputa Castle in the Sky, and
Kiki's Delivery Service.
Kiki's Delivery Service.
Yes, a new first viewing.
Yes, that
all
was
really nice films.
And rewatched some of my sister and I childhood very favorites, My Neighbor Totoro and Spirit of the Way.
Yeah,
which I absolutely adored.
Has he made a bad film? I don't think Miyazaki has ever made a bad film.
Actually, you know what I caught a bit of? Arrietty, which is really underrated.
It's pretty good. Yeah,
they're playing The Red Turtle in coming weekends.
Nice, nice.
Also really good. I don't think I can stand watching Howl's Moving Castle again quite yet. I'm going to give it a few years because I've watched the movie a lot.
I think that's actually... oh, man. This is I'm setting up a film fight because I feel you'll disagree. I feel like that's maybe his worst film. Still good.
Should we do a Studio Ghibli retrospective episode? I think we should.
I would love to do that.
Yeah, I think we should. Because I think... yeah, that would be nice. Yeah. That would be like us genuinely loving cinema rather than like hating movies for a change. So
something we all like.
Something more positive.
Is there anything more charming than the bus stop scene in My Neighbor Totoro?
No.
Honestly, in film?
No, there isn't. No.
that's not even actually a fight. That's not even a fight.
The Totoro soot ball characters in Spirited Away bringing
come
clothes
back in,
to Chihiro.
Who are in a few other films.
Right. Them bringing clothes to Chihiro, or the it's up there with the bus stop scene. Oh, actually, no. Going into those scenes in Spirited Away, it's the furnace monster with his huge arms putting the blanket on Chihiro on the other side of the room.
There's something really appealing about the slime monster, actually. I know it's disgusting, yeah. But yeah, it's just great. So sweet. It's like, I'm just one of you two, and I can't believe you're running away. And
yeah, it's great. It was really okay, we'll save this for a future installment of Film Fight Club.
But in great happiness, SBS have launched a World Movies channel, and they're celebrating by Studio Ghibli movies every weekend for the whole of July. I know what I'm doing next weekend too.
The first day of this channel was brilliant. There was like Ashes Pure White was a few days in, but then we had like Wings of Desire, we had Playtime. It's like classic films, you know. Yeah. It's really high quality. Everything gets repeated as it used to be when World Movies was a channel on Foxtel.
It's a pleasure. It's a real pleasure. Yeah. It's a thing just to put on the background now.
It's free to air. That's the most important thing.
That's the beauty of it. Because SBS used to play more films than they used to, and I was decrying that.
Chris was talking about it, you know, of the good old days.
Of SBS, the good old days are now, as the golden age cinema says.
Well, which is true. I think everything which was back in our childhood is coming back. You know, Aladdin is back.
But usually it's not in a way. Usually it's not in a good way.
Today.
Yeah, usually it's in a bad way, like Disney live action remakes. But this is in a good way.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Bringing people the best of world cinema.
Either you could see Booksmart or just stay in the comfort of your home and enjoy
just
quality movies.
Sink the knife into the declining. It could be on Channel 10.
Don't do that to yourself.
Sink the knife into the declining cinema industry by staying home is our recommendation on Film Fight Club.
Our recommendation is to enjoy.
Do go to
classic
the
cinema.
Go to the movies for
better movies.
I think My Private Idaho is playing at Golden Age this weekend. I wish I could go. I can't make it, but
there's going to be 70mm screenings of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood very soon.
It's 35mm. I don't think there's 70mm
at the Orpheum and the Ritz. Orpheum and all the Ritz.
Both.
Yeah. Okay.
Both. Yep. So there you go. Go to the movies for quality cinema.
So speaking of the movies,
Hail Satan.
Yeah.
I'm just saying Hail Satan. Hail Satan. I got to say, the funnest time I've ever had in a line at the cinema was just Hail Satan, Hail Satan, Hail Satan, Hail Satan.
Right.
The event center was
Sydney
George
Film Fest.
It was good. It was one of the film's documentaries that premiered at the Sydney Film Festival. According to Jenny Neighbor, the documentary programmer, probably the only Sydney Film Festival film in recent memory to feature a question mark in the title is obviously Hail Satan with a question mark. And it is in cinemas tomorrow.
I know. Firstly, like, kudos to Mad Men for just releasing it so quickly. Also with Parasite.
And Mad Men. December 26th. Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Portrait of My Heart Exploding.
Great.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, gosh, yeah. That's a great Boxing Day pick.
Yeah, we're going to fight about that more come Christmas.
No, we're not going to fight about it. We're just going to cry.
Yeah, it's just going to be half an hour of us crying and loving this movie.
Well, I'm going to cry. Kristen's going to fight about it.
Look, I don't have the passion to fight with you guys because I liked the film. I just wasn't so taken with it.
That's right. We'll convince Chris.
If you can convince me that it's amazing, then...
Yeah. Because it's usually Chris and I ganging up against Glenn.
Yeah,
these days,
and now the tables have turned on me.
Well, at least until December, which is a while away, but you know, we'll get there.
Yeah, Rise of Skywalker, we'll see what happens. Oh dear. That's going to compete with Portrait of a Lady on Fire. I know what I'd rather see.
Portrait of a Lady, right? Yeah, good. Okay, thank God.
Yeah.
I thought it was
that well, yeah, I definitely approve of people watching Portrait of a Lady on Fire instead of Star Wars 9. What do you think I am?
Book smart.
But I'm going to, you know, Disney have me, so I'm just going to watch it anyway. There we go.
That's the thing. Lion King, are you gonna watch that?
Next week.
No, I'm not going to.
I'm split because...
Well, who knows?
It was the first film I ever saw in cinemas.
I think it was mine as well, actually.
I have to go. I have to see it.
Look, the thing about... Disney.
But it feels like they're making a shot-by-shot live act. Like, it's practical. Like, it's almost the same.
It's quite longer than the...
Well, maybe they just have more live footage of, like, animals
But there are new songs.
If you put more Elton John in, that's fine.
You don't cast Beyoncé and not give her new songs. Because Nala doesn't have that much to do in the original film.
Maybe they're going to have, like, from her perspective, Nala is now, you know... So instead of Simba's perspective...
It would be something different.
Subverted and have Nala's perspective while she's waiting, at least from her perspective, and it'll be less of Simba and more of Nala, maybe.
If it's not a shot-for-shot remake, then I'm happy. If that's a perspective of it, then sure. At least it's to be something different. unlike Beauty and the Beast or hopefully not Mulan.
Actually, there's something funny about the Lion King. We're going way off topic from Hail Satan. Stay tuned, listeners. We'll be talking about Hail Satan in just a moment. It's funny, if you look at the trailers and the TV spots for The Lion King, they barely ever show the animals talking. I think Disney know it looks weird. It didn't look that good in The Jungle Book. Like, there's something about the mix of the photorealistic animal faces and characters talking that just, like...
Because, yeah, you can't make their faces move like animation, right? And it's just...
Just give me Homeward Bound, Milo and Otis, where they just put voiceovers over these characters and it worked. It's animals.
Good enough. Yeah, you don't need to animate to the extent that I'm sure they're going to do. The joke I've always been making about The Lion King is like, what is Can You Feel the Love Tonight going to be? Just like lions mating, you know? Like, yeah. Because
they should have like David Attenborough's commentary over it.
Chris, I can see what's happening, and they don't have a clue.
Yeah, but you can get away with this stuff in 2D animation because there's that level of remove, and because the world is so colorful and stylized. But this version is weirdly going for photorealism, which has never been the appeal of The Lion King. It's like a story that was written to be.
The eyes going to be really strange.
Oh yeah, man, the famous bedroom eyes of Nala.
Yeah.
But yeah, like it's a strange combination of a story that was made to play out as a classic Disney talking animals cartoon. And, you know, we've got to spice this up with.
I'm still amazed they haven't cast Jeremy Irons as Scar. He's like, he's
the voice. They brought back so many of the original voice actors. Oh, no, James Earl Jones.
Yeah, only James Earl Jones.
No, Scar is Chiwetel Ejiofor. Yeah.
Okay, Childish Gambino is Simba.
Yeah,
Childish Gambino.
Yeah, he's going to be rapping.
His name is obviously Donald Glover. Yes, yeah. I just think of Childish Gambino.
He is indeed Childish Gambino.
So we will be covering maybe The Lion King in the coming week. I don't know. Probably
if we can be bothered.
If we can be bothered to see it.
Like, you can tell I'm already this biased against it. Is it even a good idea to review it?
Be prepared. Yeah. Be prepared is my favorite.
Be prepared for our
review. No, Be prepared is my favorite Disney song. I love it. Whenever there's karaoke, I always sing Be Prepared.
With the Nazi
hyenas. Nazi hyenas.
But that's the thing. How do you recreate that in live action? Can you have...
Well, the rumor was they were going to cut it, but apparently maybe not.
That's the best part. That's the thing. I mean, you know, in terms of the choreography of that song, that's probably anyway.
Well, look, Disney.
Most people remember.
Disney have a lot to look forward to. Like, this shiny new era is tiptoeing nearer.
The shiny new era where, like, they own everything. The whole thing about is Avengers Endgame going to make more money than Avatar. It's like Disney wins either way. Disney own Avatar now. Avatar's at Disneyland. Fox is owned by.
Go see
just
both.
Just like.
We sing for the wonder I am.
Nothing is making money at the American box office
except for Disney. Just couldn't wait to be king.
Clearly. But like, if you look at the situation, nothing is making money except for Disney. John Wick 3 has been the only success of the summer outside of Disney releases.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah,
I'm like, surrounded by idiots.
I wonder if this is going to crater the film industry that just like people only go to see the big Disney spectacles because no one else has a successful franchise right now. You could argue Fast and Furious, but we'll see how they go now.
Oh my God, with Hobbs and Shaw. Oh God.
It's a really strange time because the film industry is super franchise focused. But none of them are succeeding outside of Disney now.
But part of the problem is that maybe
something's got to give.
Maybe we do need more original movies.
Definitely we do.
I know, but like I'm just saying maybe because some people might be like, but I love my favorite franchise, you know. So my version of people just getting up and I'm sorry.
The one we actually haven't spoken about, the other big film news of the week, they cast the Little Mermaid lead.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the actress's
Halle
name.
Berry.
Halle Berry, yeah. Yes.
I did read it like Halle Berry.
Everyone did. So much so that Halle Berry congratulated Halle Berry on Twitter. But look, it's funny. People are saying like, oh, it's, you know, it's a Danish story. It's so white. But first of all, this is not Hans Christian Andersen's The Little Mermaid. Disney's version is already way off there. And secondly, it already has a big Calypso kind of theme to it. Mm.
Yeah, don't take out the Jamaican crab. Like, he was one of the best things about the original.
Actually, you know.
Yeah. Jamaica's awesome,
yeah.
So...
Yeah,
and, music, and it's very far from Denmark.
There's definitely a lot of Jamaican influence in The Little Mermaid, so it makes sense for
if
Ariel
you
want to
be authentic,
to be
The Little Mermaid is a tragedy, all right, guys?
Yeah,
you know,
it's not...
Oh, God, she meets a brutal end.
Yeah,
there's nothing happy ending
about
that story.
Not the Danish version. So it's sort of like... Is there really?
Love is dead. Basically, that's the moral of the story.
Right. Is it really worth getting upset about, you know, internet racists?
Are people... Yeah, there, I guess there is.
Yeah.
There is people quite a bit, yeah. And Melissa McCarthy maybe for Ursula, I've heard, possibly.
Yeah, okay.
I can see. We're watching a bit of... getting through Gilmore Girls. And
part of the thing,
I can see Sophia's,
you know,
Ursula.
I'm not against casting. I'm not against it. But, like, once again, do we need... I mean, okay, maybe I'm asking the wrong question because it's not about do we need a Little Mermaid, you know, version, but we're obviously getting
obviously
it.
No.
We're obviously getting
Disney
it.
Disney want no worries the rest of their days, you know.
No. You know.
Yeah.
But, like, that's the thing. I guess Aladdin made a lot of money, more money than I was expecting, to be honest, because I thought, who needs, you know, a live-action Aladdin?
But Dumbo failed, but that's just the Tim Burton kiss of death.
And Aladdin was... I said it before, it's a perfect date movie.
Aladdin was fun. It was more fun than it should have been.
So maybe The Lion King could be fun.
I won't defend it too much, but...
but I've got to say, we were in the cinema. I watched this with Chris, and as Chris alluded to earlier, cynical Chris, the scene where the Simpra Dodd character is talking to Will Smith, she needs to change the plate, super cool, and then when she closes the door, is just having this, oh my God moment. And everyone in the cinema, including Chris, just has this big smile on
funny.
Their face. It's a funny
the
movie.
It was funny, and the performers were good. Like, these movies can be entertaining. I'm not discounting that possibility.
No. Okay.
Should we talk about Hell Satan?
Yeah.
All right, okay, yeah. Cool. Yeah.
The thing is, I don't have that much to say about Hell Satan.
We should say what Hell Satan... We don't really want a Hell Satan, but we're going to say what Hell Satan is.
Yeah.
Hell Satan is a new documentary about a group called the Satanic Temple in the United States, who you might have heard of in the context of Sabrina the Teenage Witch, the new Netflix show. Because the Satanic Temple sued Netflix for the use, without permission, of Bahamut.
Their specific design of a Bahamut statue.
Yes, which is a ghost head on an epoch torso, this 8-foot bronze statue. And Netflix settled out of court, which is quite funny.
Yeah.
So the Satanic Temple are a group who statedly promote religious pluralism and freedom for religious groups. They, in the context of this film, some of their main actions are protesting the inclusion of the Ten Commandments statues on state steps in the US by saying, hey, if you're going to have yours, we're going to be able to put up our religious symbolism too.
Yeah.
So they bring on their Bahamut statues. And the film examines to what extent this is sincere, and in the words of one advocate, to what extent this is a troll.
Yeah. There's a funny answer to that right at the end of the credits, if you stay till the very end, by the way.
There is.
But this film, it's really about people who creatively hijack the media in order to make points about separation of church and state and the way that certain conservatives in the U.S. are trying to encroach on that and make points about the need for religious pluralism instead of a specific doctrine being pushed at the government level.
I think it's also now a point in Australia, especially with the religious discrimination bill being debated or the
Don't get me started on that.
So, you know, it's...
You know, this would never have happened if... You know, we're not even going there. Continue.
Right. No, exactly.
We could talk about this for a long time.
We can, but I think it's surprising that something which kind of felt like a joke in terms of, you know, Hell Satan... Now, I feel like, no, actually, it is addressing something more salient of our times in terms of how people are reacting to things rather than actually, you know, just kind of dealing with populism. So, yeah, it's you're right. In terms of creatively hijacking other people's agendas and then making them their own, I think the film is trying to make certain points. I'm not sure if it's succeeding in making them as engagingly as it can.
I think it's entertaining at first because the... Satanic Temple are just so outrageous.
Yeah.
The reason they've had success, like I heard about the Bahamut thing when they were trying to, as you see in the film, it's actually quite a fairly small scale protest, but it had a big impact because it's so ludicrous. You sit up and pay attention when you hear
it's
people.
Quite a diverse band. Like, because news, they have all this footage. News readers love just saying the words, the Satanic Temple are on the state steps with their giant goat bronze statue. Yeah. And they know it. They know exactly what they've nailed getting into the press.
Part of the problem of this documentary, the same with the Amazing Jonathan documentary, is that nothing outside of the Satanic Temple is interesting. I think they're interesting because, you know, they just bring that level of crazy, unexpected wackiness to the proceedings. But I don't think Penny Lane, who's the director, she has anything to add to the fabric of the documentary and what how she's framing things to actually say beyond, like, you know, just look at this.
Yeah, I don't think she goes that deep in examining the temple. I think we could have seen more about, like, because it's a bit of an intrusion into the story when she shows the Detroit chapter where there's this extreme...
Yeah, I'm just about to go into this, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
There's an extreme feminist person who's running the temple there and is going against what they believe the temple's meant to be about. And that could have been the entire documentary. The story about, like, the... Because it shows how, like, the inner politics of an organization, what do we represent? Are we, you know, are we becoming like a religion in ourselves? Are we supposed to be just all for something outrageous stunts, or are we something more disciplined?
I mean, the interesting thing is, whether by design or confusion, the Satanic Temple statedly attracted a very diverse range of people. Some who are religious, statedly religious pluralists, others who would align themselves more with the values and ideals that the Satanic Temple are outwardly rejecting, but may be suggested by how the they may be appear to be branded. When you get into these breakaway chapters or problematic chapters or individuals who they don't want representing their brand, that's a fascinating part of the documentary. But they shoehorn it in towards the end. There's no real examination. It's this note of, oh, yes, this happened and we're acknowledging it. And now let's talk more about what's happening in the state steps, which is also interesting. But I didn't feel they touched enough on this to really examine or critically examine who the Satanic Temple really are, which was really crucial to how the appeal of this documentary.
I agree. It sort of comes out of nowhere because we don't really get a sense of how the Satanic Temple works behind the scenes. And then suddenly we're getting into this complex organizational disagreements and politics.
The shift and turn into the sort of Frederick Wiseman territory where it's just suddenly a fly in the wall in this inner workings of the organization kind of feels out of the blue because we're not given any kind of context as to, hang on, you know, what are the motivations? What are they actually... Because the members are so disparate, like there's nothing, no sort of overarching mission, overarching theme that you can say that, okay, this is what this organization really stands for. Mm. I think each individual is in it for their own personal agenda, their own personal reasons. And we're not even following certain individuals anyway, so we can have a sense of narrative or navigational sort of through line that we can follow either.
It's more of just a broad overarching thing of here's the organization and here's what they do, and it sort of stays that way throughout.
Yeah, the legal wrangling is hilarious, but they're either by virtue of not getting enough access or simply wanting to focus on the media circus, it's a very removed view of the group, which are very much the subject in front and center here. And even though the advocate, who's front and center for most of the film, is clearly so because he is such an interesting figure and so outward and so uncompromising in what he's prepared to do and say, he's not even...
Lucian Greaves.
Yes. He's not even the leader.
Such a
Bond
even... villain name, you know? Yeah. I can imagine him like...
He looks like Mads Mikkelsen from Casino Royale.
Or like Rupert Graves. Topher Grace from...
Right.
Die Another Day? Yeah.
He's this...
Topher Grace. No, you're thinking of... Toby Stevens.
That's right.
Who played, there's a character called Mr. Kill in that movie, damn it. But the point is, there's no Gustav Graves.
Lucian Greaves, Gustav Graves. That's right, that's what I'm thinking.
He's not the leader. Let's talk to the leaders a little bit more. Let's talk to people who are actually in charge.
Yeah, and but really, is there anyone else who's really in charge? He sort of, I think he has a fairly high up position and he says he didn't want to be sort of the leader, but he sort of felt like he had to at some point.
But I guess
the movie, this is the issue. The movie leaves us in the dark. I think it's a fairly decentralized organization.
Yeah, I think part of the appeal of the organization and why people are attracted
I'm not sure.
Being part of it seems to be
that... We just wanted some clarity.
It's not a hierarchical thing. I think, you know, people are not in charge in the way that, you know, people are in charge of organizations or cults or other places with strict... order structures.
Yeah.
I think what the appeal of the organization seems to be is that you can really bring in and make the organization your own in terms of what you bring to it.
Yeah.
And most religions do have hierarchical structures. Most major religions do. Yeah.
And hey, here we have this up and coming quote unquote religion that may become one, or maybe Detroit, may be one now.
The issue with the people in Detroit honestly feels like a religious, an issue of secession from the church kind of thing.
That could have been an entire film, actually.
It's like
I would have loved to
a reform,
reform with church within the church.
Yeah. But obviously that's counter to what the temple want to be about. But
the Protestants,
I want to explore within, more of this. Yeah, like honestly, this could have been like a 30-minute, 45-minute TV special, and you wouldn't have lost much because it repeats itself a lot. But something that I do think it does well, though, is like give a little bit of the context of why the media seizes on these images so much and why they use the satanic imagery as a troll. Because in the past, there have been really rooted in nothing various media scares about satanic imagery and devil worshippers are coming for your children. Really rooted in nothing.
I think the film is strongest when it's actually
they've hijacked that for their goal.
When it's not focusing on the satanic temple, but actually using them as a catalyst to explore how our fascination with what they're doing is basically a commentary upon us and how the media is using that about, it's more a mirror to us, but like, look, you get fascinated by these wacky stories and these people, and you get so easily conned by these people. So it's basically you as the people, which is also kind of this narrative which is now so strong within the world where, we're just trying to now blame people for being too simple and be like, we have to be more vigilant, or you have to be more smart and more critical. Use your critical thinking sense and your critical thinking abilities to actually discern everything and do the hard work, because everything is fake news and everything is a troll.
And what's interesting, more interesting, is that you have a religious cultural group which is asking to be treated on the same plane as everyone else and asking for pluralism. But they don't really. What I would have liked more is to see not just how the mainstream press, the government respond, and we did talk about how the church responded, but what about some of the other religious groups? Because there's incredible diversity in the States. I remember there was one sequence where they showed a panel, I think it was from Fox News, with a very prominent rabbi and another religious leader from another religious group. But how are minority groups, minority religions, other minority religions reacting to this? Because they would have a different perspective from a majority religious group on religious pluralism, having fairly experienced some of those issues themselves.
That's true. But the Satanic Temple, I think their main issue is to combat any one religion taking upon too much precedence. So it makes sense that it's focused more on their conflict with government and big religion.
I will say, though, they do focus very much on one religious group, being the church.
Mm.
Obviously, the church is very diverse within the United States and around the world. One part of it that really disturbed me was their response and how they went about responding to the Westboro Baptist Church. Now, this isn't a group I have any time for, but the way that they decided to activate against this was pretty disgusting.
Yeah, I thought it was out of line.
And it's okay to feature this, but then Penny Lane, the documentarians, this is a point where the documentarian implicitly or explicitly needs to come in and say, if they certainly do hold this view, hold on, this is a detraction of this group.
Or ask the church how they feel about it now, because it does seem like it's the kind of thing they did early on, but they would not do now, based on other material in the film. It seems like they've moved away from that kind of thing, but ask them about it.
Yeah.
You know?
If their response is, we made a mistake, we shouldn't have done it, okay.
Yeah.
But I wanted to know, it's important to when you betray, to show something as grotesque as that in a movie, you have to contextualize, is this the view this group holds, or is this what they actively do with other individuals or other organizations, or is this something they regret? That's much needed context, and we needed to know that if we were to get a proper clear picture of the Satanic Temple.
Yeah.
I agree, but at the same time, and I'll say this quite openly, I did enjoy this more than Booksmart, because not because of its narrative issues, but because it's just trying to engage with his own material more than Booksmart did. And even though I had lots of issues with it, those are good issues to have. I was like, angered, frustrated for good reason, rather than being just be like, why is this happening, and having a lot of WTF moments, which I had a lot in Booksmart.
So that is Hail Satan. It is in cinemas tomorrow, as is Booksmart. And One Heat Minute is, well, everywhere, and you should go listen to it.
Anywhere good podcasts are found.
And also watch Heat if you haven't seen it already. What are you doing, living under a rock?
Yeah, go watch Heat before you watch Booksmart or Hail Satan, like, seriously.
Mm. Actually, that's a fair point.
So we'll be back next week, not reviewing The Lion King. I think we'll be doing our retrospective of early 20th century films.
We still haven't figured it out, guys. Forgive us. We're super organized as always. It's a lucky dip for next week's exciting installment of Film Fight Club.
So but you honestly, don't know and neither do we. So that's great.
You know what? If you're listening to this and on Wednesday night or afterwards, get in touch with us because if you have an idea for something we should cover next week,
we want to
hear them.
Yeah,
let us know.
We'd love that.
If there's a random film you want us to talk about, a random issue, something you want us to elaborate on from this show or another
random
one.
Random year, random film genre, maybe. I don't know. Whatever you think. You think, you know, we should cover something from the 40s, something from the 30s, 50s, 60s. Some random film genres that we don't really give much attention to or you think we'd never get because we're too, you know, in tune. I don't know. Whatever you think.
Otherwise, we're going back to what, 1949 or 1950 or something.
I haven't seen much of that era to be honest, so I'll be going completely blind, so I'd love to. Yeah,
okay,
why not.
So this has been Glenn Falkenstein, Chris Evans and Virat Nehru and Blake Howard. Have a wonderful night or whenever you're listening.
Enjoy books, be book smart
and enjoy nice. yeah